today I have my wonderful friend, Scott Stover. Hello, this is Pearl M Podcast. I'm here in Hong Kong, and today I have my wonderful friend, Scott Stover. Scott, can you give a brief about yourself?
What would you like me to tell you?
Oh, not me, to tell the audience who you are, what have you been doing, and then...
Well, I've been born in Chicago. I went to school in New York. And at my university, I went to Columbia University.
Oh, which is in a big problem now.
Big problem now, but who knows? I mean, all of the universities are in a big problem at the moment. And Columbia has a house in Paris called Reed Hall. And it was kind of, it was really instrumental to my story, is that I spent my junior year, and Columbia undergraduate students were able to live in Reed Hall. Reed Hall was this beautiful 18th century house with a garden in the center in the middle of Paris. And it completely fixated my idea of living in Paris.
And at the time, could you speak French yet?
Yes.
You already speak French?
Yeah, I was already speaking French, but then my French was perfected, and I went to a university in Paris as well.
I think you have to tell people about your career.
So my career, I have an undergraduate degree in comparative literature, and then I have an MBA. And I believe that my idea was always that I would either work in a publishing house or at a museum, that having this combination of undergraduate in literature and liberal arts and a graduate degree in finance, that I would be able to use it in an unusual way. And of course, what happens when I finished business school, I worked for a bank.
You want to make money. Oh, God.
In the end, I remember what happened was I had an interview with the best publishing firm from my background, which was called Farrar, Straus & Giroux, which publishes all the French intellectuals and the philosophers and intellectuals. And they offered me a salary, I think it was $6,000 a year, which was impossible to live in. Everybody who worked at those prestigious publishing firms basically had a trust fund. I did not have a trust fund, and I accepted the job at a bank.
To be practical.
To the reality was the bank.
Yeah.
And the bank, basically, I began working in the bank in a think tank in the bank. It was a think tank that was existed to think about how the future trends would influence the banking industry. So it appealed to me because it was the intellectual part of the bank. And when I began doing it, then quickly I realized that no one listened to us. And that if you're going to work in a bank, you have to work in something that the bank was actually doing.
Yeah.
So I had an interview with the head of the bank and told them that I spoke French and that I lived in Paris and that I should be in Paris. And he told me we never send people to the place where they've lived, where they speak the language.
Really?
But then eventually I began working on a sector which was French-speaking Black Africa. And at that time, Africa, again, as it is today, was seen as the place of the future. So I built up a whole business for the bank in French-speaking Black Africa, and then it became obvious that it was inconvenient to be traveling from the United States, so I then moved it to Paris. So I eventually was able to manipulate what I wanted, and the French-speaking Black Africa was headed out of the Paris office of the bank.
Wow.
So I began working on that, then eventually, every 8 years, I changed the asset class with which I was working. I then worked on emerging markets. And after that, the final asset class I worked on was called special situations.
What is special situations?
And I became head of special situations for the bank in continental Europe. Special situations is exactly what it seems, which is companies that have some kind of difficulty or issue.
Okay.
So basically, which is really, I believe what I'm doing now is modeled after what I was doing there. It's modeled from two things. Special situations, and it's also modeled after the fact that I've been psychoanalyzed.
Oh.
Two frameworks in which I work is special situations and having been psychoanalyzed.
Oh.
So special situations, basically what it is the company has to come to you and say, I have a problem. I have a problem, and they have to say, you know, the problem is this, and I think I can do this, this, and that. And then the bank has to determine whether or not they can subscribe to the this change,
yes.
And if they can, in participating, usually we participated either in the debt or in the increase in capital,
right.
for the company. And then you help the company actually precipitate the event where it will approve.
So, Scott, how did you, when I've met you at the time, years ago, you were building American Friends of Pompidou, and you were a serious banker. How can a banker just jump and become and start working for a museum?
It was very serendipitous. And what it was about is I was working with two buddies on getting together a hedge fund. The hedge fund was on special situations, continental Europe, and we weren't getting the investors. And at that point,
you were not getting the investors.
We weren't finding the investors we needed to start the hedge fund.
Why?
Well, whatever. Reason. I mean, it turns out that my friends went on and they found the investors, but I was getting impatient. And, you know, I have a modest collection of contemporary
yes,
art.
Yes, of course.
And I believe in public institutions. I believe in museums. And I'm interested in curators. So there weren't that many American bankers living in Paris who were collecting contemporary
art. Of course,
of course. So I was rather close with quite a few curators from Centre Pompidou. Centre Pompidou being really one of the great institutions in the world.
Absolutely.
Of modern
and
contemporary art. You know, incredible. So I was very close with many of the curators of Centre Pompidou and also with the management. And at that time, if you remember, this was 2005, I think 2005. At that time, there was Nick Sirota was at the table. And Nick Sirota created a revolution in the European development model.
Absolutely.
He captured the moment when all of the world's wealthy were coming to live in London. And he created these series of acquisition committees from different parts of the world for all of the people. And it completely changed how European museums would seek funding. So the president of the Pompidou, who I knew, his name was Bruno Racine, he asked me, he said, Scott, you see what Nick Sirota is doing, you know, what do you think we could do? Do you think we could do something? You know, and shouldn't we begin in America if we do something? And I said, I don't know. And I said, I have to think about it. So I thought about it. Then we continued discussions. And then he asked me, could I write a paper on it? I said, sure. So I wrote a paper, what I thought we should be doing. And then he said to me, we want you to do it. So that's really how it happened. It was just, and I thought, you know, my God, basically, you know, the environment in France is unfavorable fiscal environment.
Yes.
You know, my accountant kept telling me, you know, you have to leave France. And a lot of my friends, all of the friends who were successful in finance, and most of them had gone to London. I don't like London.
You don't like London? How can you not like London?
I don't like London. And basically, I like America. And
because
I
you're
like,
American,
and I,
of course.
And I like Americans. And I thought, my God. And I thought, I did the MBA and I wanted to work at a museum. Here, all of a sudden, Bruno Racine is giving me the opportunity to work with one of the great museums in the world. And I had not lived in America my whole adult life. I had only lived in Paris. And I thought, well, this is the opportunity. Voila. So that's how it happened. So it was completely serendipitous. And then basically it was the model for everything that I do. And
when you say the model of everything you do, explain that model, elaborate,
please. Yeah, the model is basically that nonprofit projects should be structured like for-profit projects. They should have a business plan, they should have a strategy, a business plan, 1, 3, 5, and preferably 10 years, particularly if you want them to be sustainable. And you also have to look at the competitive environment.
You left being the head of the American Friends of Pompidou. Is it still sustainable after you left? You talk about sustainability. Is it still sustainable?
The current chairman, so mm-hmm. this is now 20 years after I began it,
yeah.
is someone who I brought in.
Yes.
Who was Suzanne Deal Booth is now the chair of
is
now the chair of the American Friends of the Pompidou, and the previous chair, Steve Gutman, since I left, is also someone that I brought in. So it is sustainable. And then, and they just recently celebrated the 20 years, and I was recognized, and there's a little book and all of this. So yes, it is sustainable. The structure is different.
The structure is different.
The structure is slightly different than when I did it, but it has sustained.
So who is standing in your place?
No one.
No one?
Basically, during the 8 years when I was executive director, so I'm founding executive director
yes.
of the Centre Pompidou Foundation, I raised the equivalent of $50 million.
Yeah.
After I stopped being executive director, I was on the board for another 2 years. So I basically worked for the Pompidou for 10 years. So in that period, $50 million was a lot of money. And the French
you never raised any of
that. They raised,
money.
You know, about $1.5 million yeah. a year. And the majority comes from one person, one or two very generous French individuals, you know, would give a check
yes.
when asked. So as you can imagine, you know, everybody was looking to what I was doing, everybody in this universe of
yeah.
museum development universe, mostly because they know the French are not user friendly. And how was Scott able to be so successful? So people were looking at it a bit, but what that meant is the French were uncomfortable. What would the Americans want? When they're providing all of this money for the French institutions, what will they ask? They must want something in return. Voila. So basically, after I left, they were able to change the structure to have everything controlled from Paris. So basically, I had set up an autonomous U.S.
yes,
structure, because
yeah.
it's a U.S. foundation, in the same way that the Louvre has, that
yes.
the Tate has, that, you know, one of the great example is the Ashmolean, the mm. American Friends of the Ashmolean. We all have autonomous U.S. structures
of course,
in place.
Need to have that,
given
actually.
The importance of the U.S. donor, they all exist in the same way. I did the same way, but the political environment at the museum at that time did not like that there was an autonomous U.S. structure. So since I left, they were able to consolidate everything in Paris.
Oh, interesting. Oh, my God. You actually raised $50 million for Pompidou Raffle.
Yeah.
Very good. I also and I also visited the glass house, which I thought was amazing. The glass house is Pierre Charot's only architecture, the only building, and you got it to be donated
no.
to Pompidou. No?
What? No, 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 no. The,
no?
The, no, no. The glass house
yes.
Belongs to my first chairman, who is Bob Rubin, who is a very
Bob
close
Rubin,
friend of mine.
Yeah.
He has not donated La Maison
oh, he's
Vert.
Not donated
no, no.
Yet.
He donated the Prouvet Tropical House.
Oh, where is the Prouvet Tropical?
It belongs to the Centre Pompidou.
Oh.
So the first major donation that I was able to get for the Centre Pompidou was, and it was a time when Prouvet was not known like he is today.
Well, today, that house,
so he
God.
Gave, he gave, he bought and he renovated the Tropical House, which he gave to the Pompidou. And for several years, it was shown on one of the terraces at the Pompidou.
So, and so he also owned the glass house.
Maison Vert.
Yeah, because when you took me there,
yeah.
that was not donated there.
No, it still is not donated, and I don't think
that is an architectural yeah. miracle. I mean,
yeah,
that
I don't think it's his intention to.
That is an establishment.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary piece.
It's extraordinary.
Extraordinary.
Okay, let's talk about it. So after what makes me feel that I really need to invite you for this podcast, is because from a banker. You start to do a museum, and now you are advising people how to create charity.
Nonprofit initiative.
Nonprofit in, I mean, organization
it's,
or,
it's,
or,
it's,
or
it's
industry.
Exactly, it's exactly the same. I work in the same framework. So the framework is...
But hold on first. What makes you, what inspired you to do that? First thing. What is the inspiration?
The inspiration is to do good for society. I don't have the same means as some other people.
Then you can donate.
So the next best thing that I can do is help them realize what they want to do. So if I'm working, actually it's the same, if I'm working for individuals or if I'm working for companies or foundations, it's basically very simple. And it also has to do with having been psychoanalyzed. I think there are four basic questions that we discuss when you're beginning this kind of initiative. The first thing is, what do you want to do? Then secondly, why do you want to do this?
Why? Yeah.
Why do you want to do this? Thirdly, who is the audience you want to address? And fourthly, what are your criteria for success? In other words,
you mean these are the four points
for polls.
Polls.
When you initiate an initial nonprofit project.
Okay.
You know, you have to address that. And of course, and basically, this is the most difficult thing in the work that I do. That first of all, people have to be honest with themselves. In other words, there's nothing good or bad. If someone wants to do this initiative to promote themselves socially, it's better they're honest.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I don't want them to be unhappy with their philanthropic activity.
Exactly.
They have to be happy. So they have to be honest with themselves, and they basically have to be able to articulate it. Mostly, I find people are not clear on what they want to do and why they want to do it.
Tell me more about this, your company and how you advise people and all that.
I realize now that I've been doing this since 2005, that I did invent a profession which is terribly fulfilling. To be able to, all these people talk to me about their different projects and different ideas and things they want to do to make the world a better place. And mostly, I hope, I help them realize what they want to do.
I'm very interested when you tell me about the other projects that you were doing, like the book project, the publisher project.
The publisher was Kaye Dar. So Kaye Dar is a mythic publisher in France.
When you say mythic, explain that.
You know, now I can't remember, but I think it was begun in 1924. I should look up the year. So it was begun in 1924 or something like that by Christian Zervos, who was a Greek immigrant to Paris.
Yeah.
And he quickly became friends with all of the great artists who were living in Paris at that time. And he published on an irregular basis a review, like a magazine, usually about twice a year, but on an irregular basis, he published a magazine. He had a small shop front on Rue de Dragon, and he had exhibitions on Rue de Dragon, and he had a printmaking. So he had exhibitions, a review, and printmaking. And he has published all of the famous artists from 1926, I think he died in 1976. During that period, all of the famous artists who we know, Matisse, Picasso, all of them were published, and most had exhibitions, and many also had printmaking by Kaye Dar. So if you're studying Picasso, if you're studying Matisse, you will inevitably looking at old issues of Kaye Dar's review. And then he's probably most famous because he published Picasso's Catalogue Raisonné. And the Catalogue Raisonné, which is, now I forget, it's something like...
must be huge.
I can't remember, 33 volumes or 70.
8, 000,
all of a sudden, I can't remember how many volumes. But still, it was published. So Zervos, the owner, worked on the Catalogue Raisonné while Picasso was alive. So the two were working together, the two were friends. Zervos died, and it was completed after Zervos's death, but it is still the Catalogue Raisonné, which is the reference for anything that is done on Picasso. So anything that is done in terms of exhibitions or sales, they will refer to the Zervos, but it's Chris Kaye Dar, volume X, page Y. Is it? So basically, in 1976, when Zervos died, it became dormant. And a Swedish collector who was the son of a very famous Swedish collector, his name is Staffan Ehrenberg, he bought Kaye Dar with the idea of relaunching all of its activities. So he relaunched all of the activities, and he asked me to look at his business and determine whether or not some of the business lines could be spun off into a U.S. nonprofit.
To a U.S. nonprofit?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so basically it was clear in looking at the business revenues that the activity of Catalogue Raisonné was basically catalog resume, you can't make money.
No.
You know, it just has, it has enormous time, et cetera. Right. And so it was obvious that we could spin off the creation, printing, et cetera, of catalog resume into a U.S. nonprofit having as its mission, you know, it has an education mission open to public. And I thought that it would have potential to seek in, you know, donors from the U.S. public. So we decided to spin off the catalog resume function. I created the Cahiers d'Art Institute. And while we were creating it, Staffan had the idea that it should be, that the future is digital.
Yes, of course, it is.
That clearly, you know, printing these, because immediately when you print a catalog resume, it's out of print.
Yeah.
So, and if you have the you know, all of the online interest of a digital catalog resume. So we began to seek a solution to create a software which would be able to print the catalog resume. And in doing that research, we realized that PACE had created a logiciel and had created software for catalog resume, but they weren't making money. So we had this idea with Staffan, you know, why don't we talk to PACE? And Staffan did talk to PACE, and he suggested that PACE donate it to our newly created U.S. nonprofit Cahiers d'Art Institute, which they agreed to do.
Bravo.
Voila.
When is it, when is this nonprofit organization going started?
It exists.
Oh, it exists already.
It exists. So basically, PACE had already published eight catalog resume, which are now belonging to Cahiers d'Art Institute.
But actually, what you are doing is completely out of the box.
Yeah, it's completely out of the box.
Completely out of the box.
I'm inventing something new.
Yeah, you are using an investment banking idea
completely
to create a solution. Actually, you're giving solution. You're not just advising something, but if someone has an idea, you give a solution.
And what I also do, if it's important, is I agree to run the new nonprofit, because that's what I did with the Salt Park Foundation.
Are you running that?
No, now I'm not. I did at the beginning,
The
first 2 years. So often the first 2 years I run it, I put everything together, see that it's functioning, see that everything works. And then often I, you know, pass it on to someone else.
And now you are helping my artist to build a foundation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I have the great joy of working with Su Xiaobai and his wife. And the idea, as you know, he is 76, I believe. His wife is 59. He has been extremely successful. He has three very important, very wealthy collectors who have collected his work in depth. And now he's mostly interested in his legacy. And what he wants is that I understand correctly what they want. What he wants is to assure that the world will know his work. And the
also,
world will know
and
it
also
better.
After when he passes.
And after when he passes.
His work will be still celebrated.
Absolutely.
And that is the most important thing.
Yeah, so what he wants, so what we're doing is basically the mission of the foundation is that it becomes better known, that we work with museums, that we work with art historians, that we work with curators. And voila,
this is quite a straightforward thing.
Rather straightforward. This whole sector of artist-endowed foundation.
I mean, that's very straightforward then.
It's quite straightforward. This whole sector of artist-endowed foundation is a growing sector in my world. So I already have done some work with Vasarely, and I've done work with Nikki de Saint-Phalle. But this is, as artists have become successful, particularly, you know, United States artists, but also some European artists, as they become successful, they create their own foundation.
Of course, because there are many artists, American artists actually, building foundation, but a lot of them wasn't successful. So how do you see this, because what you did with your career, what you did, this advisory of nonprofit organization is actually a very, you actually invented this.
I invented it, but it all seems to have continuity in my mind.
Yeah.
I feel it's all been built in everything that I've done, you know, including basically being psychoanalyzed.
Yeah, because tell me more about your special situation, what you did with the bank and how you apply that to what you're doing now?
It'll be the manager. The manager or the founder of a company, you know, will come to, let's say they come to me, but it's not usually just to me. They'll be shopping around and they will saying, you know, I have this problem. You know, usually it could be declining sales. It could be, you know, I need some debt. I mean, whatever, a whole series, or I have too many assets that I can't get rid of. You know, they would come to you and they would say, you know, this is the problem. And I think that my solution is XYZ.
Yeah.
You know, and they would come and they would say they have a problem. They would suggest a solution. And then I would work with them in trying to figure out, is this a solution? Could there be other solutions? And we would create then a business plan. And then I would usually present it to, you know, a pool of finance people.
That is what you're doing now, right?
It's the same thing. It's really very similar. To me, it's very similar. And it's basically, it goes back to the fact that the initiator of the project could be the company, which becomes a special situation. It could be the philanthropist who wants to do something. They have to first say, I want to do this, and my vision is that, and this is why I want to do it, and I suggest I should do it in this way.
Okay.
So it all seems very similar to me.
All right. So next question for you is that you have a podcast.
Yes.
It's called Giving Back is Dead. Okay. Do you really believe that giving that back is dead? What do you think about the next 50 years, let's say? I mean, giving back is dead. So
I think that, you know, basically, all the people of our generation hate this is the title.
I love it.
You know, and I came up and basically,
I love it because I think is something that you arouse people to talk about it, to think about it.
That's right. That was the idea.
It is controversial. And I don't think giving back is dead in America or in Hong Kong.
It's not dead.
But in different countries, because of the socialist system, people are unlikely to give as if you are in a very capitalistic
society. No, I basically, I said there are a few reasons. One is to be provocative.
Yeah.
And I thought to be provocative, people would pay attention.
Yeah.
That was the idea.
Yeah.
And also it was the idea that I see a change happening in how people give. So I see a tremendous change in how they're doing it. Basically, what is happening, I think it became someone we both know, Neil Benezra, you know, who was the head of SF MoMA many years ago. He said to me, Scott, I'm unable to engage Silicon Valley. Can you help? What should we do? I can't, you know, here there are all these wealthy people, Silicon Valley, what should we do? And I said to him, why don't you go talk to them? I said, why don't you go talk to them and figure out how you can engage them? You know, I said, talk to them. And I realized, and it's still really much the same, that basically what is happening is it's basically I'm looking at giving in the cultural sector. So I'm talking mostly about, you know, not about giving to the poor. I'm talking about giving to arts and culture, arts, culture, science. You know, mostly I find, and particularly, you know, with the museums, what they all do and they continue to do is they come up with a list of things they are offering donors. And if you give 10,000, you get that. If you give 50, you get that. If you give 100, you get this. And they then give it. And they say, what do you choose? That doesn't work anymore.
No.
And it really doesn't work for the young. So basically, so in particular, and so what happened is, since I began thinking, well, I said that to Neil, why shouldn't I do this? So that's how I decided to do the podcast. The podcast is basically, essentially, I've tried to identify mostly millennials who are doing creative, innovative projects, nonprofit projects in arts and culture. So I've tried to find people who are innovating in nonprofit projects and having long interviews like we're doing here today to try and come up with themes by which they are engaged and themes with which we can engage other people to continue giving to the arts. To be more specific, the baby boomers, you know, our generation, basically, and of course I'm talking about principally in the United States, which is the largest...
donors, of course.
Yeah, the largest donor market is in the United States. What's happened in the United States is we created a system which is really based on being accepted to an elitist club.
Yes.
It's created as a social club.
Yeah.
This is a social club where you're chosen to be a member, you know, the most prestigious, let's say the Metropolitan Museum. You know, people have to years and years of proving that they can give, that they're good. And then you are just like a member in a social club. Then you are asked to be a part of the social club and you're belonging to that social club. And what you get out of it is determined by how much money you have and you give.
Yeah.
Millennials don't like that. They do not like that. They do not want to be a part of an elitist social club. At least that's what they say. You know, and it's not true for everybody. Basically, I believe in general. So there have been several themes that have come out. So I've now done 36 podcasts.
Yeah.
So it begins to, you can see themes. You know, themes is basically they want to make the world a better place. I believe
they want to make the world a better place. Absolutely.
And
I believe that as well.
And they really have, it's particularly difficult for us in arts and culture because they do question why. Why should I give to arts and culture when there are people who have
real needs. Food, shelter, and all that,
So basically, when we turn to arts and culture, the themes are, they like, basically, they want to address underrepresented communities.
Yes.
Okay. Underrepresented communities.
They want to see justice, they want to see fairness.
And you can integrate this in your cultural project. So underrepresented communities, education. So education, I mean, I think among the, I mean, there. I think there have been quite a few powerful podcasts that I've done, but you know, if I can think of one that comes to mind, I mean, I don't want to say that it, in excluding the other ones, but one is with Anna Raginskaya. And she came, she said, actually, we had to redo the introduction because after we did the podcast, she came, she called me maybe a week later or 2 weeks later. And she said, you know, Scott, I think I haven't been sufficiently honest in the She's a Harvard undergraduate, Harvard MBA, a very impressive young woman who I'm very fond of. And now we've become friends. And she said, you know, I haven't been completely honest. And she said, I'd like to redo the beginning. And we redid the beginning. And she talked about the fact she came, she and her family emigrated, a Jewish family from the Ukraine, and emigrated to New York. And her mother enrolled her in arts education at Metropolitan Museum, which she did outside of school. And she said it completely changed her life and her attitude and what opportunities were available to her. So education, I think education in the arts really counts. Voila, so that. And they want also things like millennials want the nonprofits to have autonomous income generating activities. So basically,
they want something which is sustainable.
Sustainable. And they don't want, you know, basically they want the nonprofits to get out of this vicious cycle of having to constantly ask the wealthy for money, ask the wealthy for contributions. So they're willing to give, the wealthy millennials are willing to give if they can also create a new revenue line for the nonprofit. This is a theme. They don't want the nonprofit to only be dependent on donations.
So we are talking about America, right?
Yeah.
So
mostly America, but I think it's similar now in Europe. And one of the things that
I don't think in Asia applies.
Asia, of course, you know,
In Asia applies. I think it's changing, but I don't think Asia applies. And China giving is for complete different reasons. But Hong Kong, among all the Asian countries, Hong Kong is the most generous.
I know that's the case, and I wanted
the most generous. And when we give here, it's not about tax deduction. There's no tax and tax deduction. But we, because we pay very low tax, so we are very happy to give. I think it's a very different way of giving.
You know, I'm not sufficiently, I would like to know more about the what drives Asians. And I think that's something that I should add to my podcast, actually.
I mean, because
I do want to have a global approach. And you're right, I should learn more about Asia.
But America is the most important. It's true. But in Europe, it's very difficult because of the socialist government system. Your tax is so high that everybody is expecting, you know, you're being looked after by your government. So your schools,
your health,
in Europe, your medical and everything. So I don't think people is more willing to give as much as it is in America or in Asia. Or not Asia, I mean in Hong Kong or whatever.
I think these are all complicated issues.
Of course it is.
I was surprised, you know, recently reading your interview in the FT, you said correctly, I believe, that good collectors exist when they are great museums.
That was the quote that they...
I think that's correct.
That is,
I think this is correct.
I think, you know, when people is questioning it, Hong Kong now has the best, among all the whole Asia, we have the best infrastructure.
I think there's a ways to go.
And it's cultivating very good collectors.
I think
it's a great groundwork, and now we have a very healthy and infrastructure.
But what interested me is then you went on to say that you thought that what was needed in Asia was more government support for more in order to create this necessary museum infrastructure without which you wouldn't have great collectors, which I agree. But what surprised me is, as you know, in the U.S., we have almost no government support.
No. You only have one institution, right, with government.
Yeah, Washington.
Yeah, Washington.
But even that, they have substantial private donations.
But then when you have totally private museum, you're controlled by the trustees as well.
That's true.
Right? So I think you need to have this mixture of you know, you have government support, but you also raise. It's also not so good is if you have a government who try to control everything. So you need to have both. I think this...
First of all, I totally agree with you that I think both is the healthiest environment.
I mean, it's the healthiest.
And I'm among the people do not like it. And I have been quoted in interviews regularly that since the U.S., the federal government, is providing a tax deduction, there is government support
in the form of
a tax deduction. And I believe that we should have representatives from the public on the museum boards. And people do not like that
Your
I say
museum
this.
Would not like it at all. Of course not.
But I have been a rather...
You're very radical, my God.
But as you know, it's more the UK model. The UK model integrates public and private.
No, UK model is that the government does give money.
Yes.
But they won't get, today especially, they cannot give enough. So it will be also depending on private raising money.
Absolutely.
UK people, but living in UK because of tax, you're paying so much that people are very unlikely to donate. So they raise money internationally. And of course they have the board of acquisition board everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think I agree with you. I think that a private public model serves the public better. But it is clear that when you look at the US museums,
they're all private.
Yeah, we've created extraordinary museums in the United States.
Extraordinary.
That does not have the...
And they're so rich.
Yes.
Every museum is so rich. But they also have very good corporate sponsorship.
It does not have the advantage of places like Paris, which has benefited from people, you know, donating works of art en lieu of capital gains on the art.
And also inheritance, they can settle with.
Well, for the inheritance, that's right.
But in America as well.
Paris, the institutions are so extraordinary as a result of all of the art that was collected there. Yeah. And it's basically when you're paying inheritance taxes, they give it to the museum. So America hasn't really benefited from that.
No, America also. A lot of my friends, whoever died, and they would settle with the artworks.
Yes. But they also, people do give during their lifetime.
Yes, they do.
And we've established this extraordinary museum infrastructure And it's really been private individuals.
I mean, they give during the lifetime is because of a tax deduction.
It's not only the tax deduction.
No.
I think the tax deduction counts. The tax deduction counts. But I think people are motivated for a variety of reasons. So going back to the future, you said, do I anticipate that giving will decrease in the future? No. And what we're seeing, you know, now, one of the reasons, of course, why I was interested in looking at the millennial and Generation Z attitude towards giving is, you know, we have this great wealth transfer that's occurring. So in the next 30 years, there will be more than $1 trillion of wealth that will be transferred between generations. And I do believe that the arts will continue to be supported.
Don't you feel that, you know, the way that a person starts giving back to the society is actually being conditioned or being cultivated when you're growing up, whether it is in education or whether it is an example that your parents or someone give. So this is ongoing because of a general education.
I resist thinking only that, but maybe unless you think in a larger way.
I'm talking about
Let's imagine that someone who is from a very underprivileged background could have a generous mother who then teaches them about giving because they give. So if you look at it in that way, yes. But one of the things that has surprised me in the 36 podcasts that I've done is I don't see a distinction between how the wealthy millennials who have inherited wealth approach giving from those who are self-made. So I would have anticipated there would be a real difference. For instance,
there is
not a real difference. It's a generational vision that's different.
I think the self-made would most likely to give more.
We do not have data which distinguishes.
If you look at, I hope there will be some data coming out.
I think. At the moment I'm trying to find sponsors for giving to the Arts Report. I haven't told you about that?
No. Can you say maybe we have some audience who will sponsor Scott on this data, please?
Basically, now that I've done these 36 podcasts, I want to begin to put data. You know, data. Figures don't lie. So, you know, we want to look at data, and so I want to come out with a report where we get generational distinctions.
That is very important, I think
giving.
So.
So I basically...
Because without that, you can't study and you won't have a full comprehension of what is happening.
So basically what I've done is I've structured a report and we want to conduct a proprietary survey to be able to distinguish generational attitudes toward giving. And basically the themes that I've been able to find out in the podcast will then be tested with the proprietary survey.
Today, there is so much turmoil in the geopolitical situation. Like US, China are having this trade conflict, and it's getting so bad that it really affects America as well as China.
Absolutely.
So what's your take on that affects all these art and culture?
Basically, I have a different vision than most experts. I suppose that as you've permitted me to have some understanding of China and to have close Chinese friends, which is not only you, but other Chinese friends as well. And I really do not, particularly with Chinese, I do not feel that there is an enormous cultural difference. First of all, the major traits of the culture are education.
Mm.
And a meritocracy.
Yes, a meritocracy.
And my interaction with the Chinese, they seem to have the same kind of framework than Americans, and something which is also practical. We are practical people. I really do not, I mean, I know I'm obviously wrong, I do not understand this conflict. The two economies are interdependent. They are interdependent. And the Chinese and the Americans are practical people. I do not see how they can be disconnected. This will not happen. Voila.
But this is happening.
We are living with Trump today. You're seeing how things can evolve dramatically overnight.
They change from one day to another.
Which you did not anticipate. And certainly, it seems to me today that there is an enormous opportunity for China. And we have, and recently, the things that have happened, for instance, even in terms of the business community, you have DeepSeek, which is all of a sudden
DeepSeek is amazing.
Completely shattered, you know, the dominance of U.S. tech and BYD. You know, BYD has just come out with this super battery. I mean, the world is integrated, and there is this opportunity
now. But remember, Scott, you know how China is feeling and how Chinese is feeling today is we're feeling being bullied again, because after 150 years of Western dominance, being bulldozed at the time during the Qing Dynasty, today China feel proud that there's so much success on every different fields, and all of a sudden tariff, we have seen Hollywood movies pinpointing, you know, Chinese being the bad person, you know, all that thing going on. Of course, I think in China they don't feel well with all these conflicts going on.
Who likes a bully? No one likes a bully. Trump is a bully. I don't see who would like being a bully.
No,
but
I believe this is how Chinese is being.
Well, I can.
I
understand
so,
that.
So if you can understand that, you can understand a lot of reactions.
I do not believe that this will continue.
I don't think so as well.
I think and I think that these are the two most important economies in the world, which offer each other something. They cannot be disconnected.
And I hope that art, culture will bring things together.
Absolutely.
Will bring the two countries together.
Which is what we both have been working on.
Thank you, Scott, for spending this whole hour with me. And now I'm hungry. I have to go and eat.
Well, thank you so much, Pura.
Thank you so much.
I must say that you have been important to my life.
Oh, that's
you
so
have,
sweet.
You have introduced me to a whole part of the world that I didn't know. And without you as my guide, I wouldn't know it.
Great. I mean, you have to explore more, come to Asia more. Thank you, Scott. Thank you for everything.